Well, not many preachers preach this bit of the Bible, it appears. I can understand why. No one is going to speak on marriage and divorce to a church full of people in the 21st century without feeling it's the pastoral equivalent of walking through a minefield. Such are the inevitable sensitivities around. I turn to our own online sermon library for help, but there is not a single sermon on these verses in the whole collection. Well, to be absolutely honest, there is one marked Matthew 19, verses 1 to 30, but when you listen, the preacher begins at verse 13. How wise. I checked another church's sermon library and found there were two talks there, and when I looked more closely, I saw one of them was mine. Some 25 years ago. I didn't have any record of it at all, and I couldn't face the thought of sitting in my study listening to myself and making notes on my own talk, so I listened to the other one. Actually, this is the kind of passage that the curate normally gets to preach, and he starts the sermon blaming the rector for dumping the topic on him. If the rector preaches, well, he's either very brave or very foolish. I mean, so foolish he would ask Dan Wells to put the series together and then say, Hugh, I can do a couple back-to-back at the beginning or the end, you choose. And then with a smug smile, because Dan can produce a smug smile if he wants to, he went on, but either way, you get Matthew 19, 1 to 12. So here we are, facing this highly charged, pastorally sensitive, deeply personal issue, where you don't want a pair of size 10 boots doing anything but tiptoeing around, and then you find it isn't being raised as a pastoral issue. It's more a theory one. It's sparked off by a trick test question. So we're not even going to get a comprehensive lecture for an answer, and there'll no doubt at the end still be plenty of what about this and what if that and what now questions left. Which is why in the Resources Centre, there's not just this book about marriage, but a number of books and booklets that touch on some of the issues that'll be raised here. Because for our few minutes, we're going to focus on what Jesus does say here. And let me talk you through it, because the sequence matters. As they say, context is everything. And it begins with what I've called the trap is set. See, come to the beginning of the chapter. When Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee, that's up north, and he went into the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. He's heading south towards Jerusalem, where the whole story will be played out in the end. And verse 2, large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Jesus is still something of the new preacher on the block, and whether the settings were rural or urban, he pulled in the crowds. In a God culture, as it was then, you could go along wondering what it might be to be his disciple. You might wonder whether this could be a fresh start, and if so, what would it involve, and could I be included? But others would be there too. So you see verse 3? Some Pharisees came to him. Now understand, Pharisees were not the clergy, they're not the ministry team. They were powerful lay people of the day who made up that layer of the religious establishment. And they did not come to join Jesus. Now, look how the verse goes on. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. See, he's a threat to their establishment. They are the guardians of the flame, you know, the defenders of the faith, and they're there to expose the new teacher for who he is. So they asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Now notice, they don't ask, can he divorce his wife? They ask, can he divorce for any and every reason? Because back of the question is one of those religious turf wars, triggered by a couple of rabbis, Shammai and Hillel. Two rabbis whose followers took strikingly different interpretations when it came to divorce. Both took a phrase from Deuteronomy chapter 24, one of the foundational Old Testament books, which seemed to allow divorce for, quote, something indecent. The followers of Shammai, they took a conservative position. They allowed divorce, but purely for sexual immorality and gross indecency. The followers of Hillel, on the other hand, took a more relaxed, liberal interpretation, if you like, that allowed divorce. Well, it seemed to go more and more for any complaint the husband might have, including spoiling the dinner. You know, the steak's tough, the veg are overcooked, the gravy's lumpy, you're out. Do not imagine that that sort of fickle trade in, trade up, have an eye out for the new must-have model that we apply to motor cars, mobile phones, marriage, is a modern-day attitude. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Come on, Jesus, which half of the congregation do you want to lose? Actually, it wasn't just a religious hot potato. It was a political hot potato too. King Herod had recently divorced, only to remarry to his brother's wife. That had drawn the fire of the other great popular preacher of the day, John the Baptist, and John had lost his head over it, literally. So, no pressure, Jesus. But we're all listening, and the vultures are circling. Is it lawful to divorce for any and every reason? Now, Jesus is good under pressure, very good. Watch him, because he takes us back to, what I've called the creator's blueprint about marriage. Look at verse 4. "Haven't you read," he replied. And you sense a bit of a put down here. He's speaking to the Bible bashers of the day. He's quoting from Genesis 1 and 2, the first book of the Bible. I think it's around page 1. Have you read that far? "Haven't you read that at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his mother and father and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh." Look carefully at what Jesus says, because he explains so much about what marriage was intended to be. It is, for example, something God-given. I mean, did you notice in verse 4, he says the Creator made them and the Creator said. Jesus attributes this original explanation of marriage not to the narrator, which is how it reads in Genesis 2, but to the Creator. Marriage is a God-given relationship and a God-designed relationship, and I mustn't reduce it just to a social contract or a personal lifestyle choice. He designed it. He defines it. Not me. It's God-given. It's complementary. Not complementary with an I, you know, "you're lovely, darling. That was a wonderful meal. Thank you for making so much effort." Though that kind of complementary is always worth having as an ingredient to the marriage. But it's complementary with an E. You know, something different that makes the other whole. Notice how Jesus combines Genesis 1:27, "the Creator made them male and female," with Genesis 2:24, "a man will be united to his wife." I don't think I'd seen the link so well before, but it couldn't make it clearer. Jesus sees marriage as a union between a man and a woman, a relationship they were created for. It's why when some say Jesus said nothing about same-sex relationships, they ignore these verses. Oh, I know the Jewish culture of the day, Old Testament teaching, was opposed to same-sex relationships, but for someone as unafraid to speak out against cultural taboos as Jesus, his silence here is deafening. And what he does say about marriage couldn't be clearer. It's between a man and a woman. That's why Christian marriage is different from civil marriage as it is now in this country. It's God-given. It's complementary. It's exclusive. Marriage is intended as an exclusive relationship. Look at verse 5. "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, leave his birth family to take up this new allegiance to create a new family unit. And he does the leaving, not just she, and be united to his wife. The word has got the idea of glue behind it, a glue so strong there's room for no one else. God-given, complementary, exclusive, and permanent. See, verse 5 goes on, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. He repeats it. Marriage is designed to do that, to unite us. Sex cements us physically. I mean, sex is fun, sex brings joy, sex can bring new life. It also unites and cements a relationship physically, which is why to use it outside of marriage, to use it without intending this kind of one flesh relationship, is so deceitful. It's to say one thing with my body, to promise a relationship I have no intention of living. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. See, marriage is far more than just a piece of paper. I mean, if it were just that, well, then you could screw it up and throw it away. Then divorce could be a reasonable solution to any problem marriage. But how do you separate one flesh? Therefore, that which God has joined together, let no one separate, he says. Remember the wedding service? There comes that moment where a bride and groom have made their vows to each other, and the minister says they've done everything that he said they would do during the service, and he says, I now declare they're husband and wife. And you know the next thing the minister says? I now declare they're husband and wife, and you take both their hands together, and you say immediately after it, that which God has joined together, let no one divide. See, divorce is not an easy out. It's us undoing the work of God. Well, there's the Creator's blueprint for marriage. But if he thought that had satisfied the question, well, there's more to come. You see, the trap's been set. Now the trap is sprung in verse 7. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? We have read our Bible, say the Pharisees. We got beyond Genesis 1 and 2. We read all the way to Deuteronomy 24. And there, divorce is implicit, provided there's the right paperwork. You know, it seemed that a husband back then could even divorce his wife in the middle of a drunken stupor. And Moses is trying to curb the worst of excesses. He had at least to sober up enough to sign the papers, and everyone could know for sure where they stood. Are you saying Moses has got it wrong, Jesus? I mean, marriages do break down, don't they, without any bad things happening, so to speak. He's not the man I married, she said to me. And as we talked for a bit, I said, well, it's not a big surprise, is it? I mean, you married in your early 20s. You're nearly 50 now. Think of the life experiences he's been through. Do you really expect him to be the same as he was at 22? I'd be very surprised if you're the same woman as you were then, either. See, that's the thing about marriage, isn't it? We're all changing all the time. And you have to handle the changes within the relationship. Claire, my wife, said to me the other day, she said, Hugh, I love you for who you are, not for who you were or even who you want to be, but for who you are. It's a wonderful thing to be told. It's a necessary thing to be told, really, as a marriage goes on. Because marriage is not a static package deal. It's a dynamic relationship. For keeps, says Jesus. Only, didn't Moses allow divorce if it got too hard for us? Are you saying Moses got it wrong, Jesus? Do you really know your Bible? Of course, they're going to have to do better than that to put Jesus off his stroke. And he comes back at them, contrasting the Creator's blueprint with hard hearts as he talks about divorce and remarriage. Look at verse 8. Jesus replied, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not so from the beginning." And that's where you need to start, says Jesus. See, the Pharisees want to talk about divorce. Jesus wants to talk about marriage. The Pharisees want to talk about divorce. Jesus insists on starting with marriage. Don't turn a concession. Notice Moses permitted, verse 8, not Moses commanded, as in verse 7. Don't turn a concession into the ideal. Don't even turn the norm into the ideal if it was not this way from the beginning. It's a great reminder, a great lesson to us. The new moralists are always pointing to what's happening on the ground, you know, where the culture is, what the TV's mimicking and reinforcing, and they start their ethics there. Don't you see, Hugh? You've got to allow. These days, you must. Jesus wants us to start at the beginning. With marriage, a pre-Genesis 3, pre-fall ideal, not with divorce, a post-fall provision. Because we won't understand the true place of divorce, a provision for hard hearts, not a norm, if you don't understand God's intention for marriage. Now, our law courts these days, they operate a no-fault divorce approach, and there are some good reasons for that, but divorce cannot be a morally neutral option. At the very least, it's a sign that sin and hardness of heart have been at work within the marriage. But it was not this way from the beginning. In the beginning, the two became one flesh permanently, which is why Jesus heads where he does in verse 9. Look at verse 9. I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. Now, there's a consistency to what Jesus says here. If the two became one flesh is at the heart of marriage, then divorce and remarriage tears apart what God was putting together. It may be permitted for hardness of heart, but it still has consequences. If sexual unity in marriage was the plan of the Creator, then sexual promiscuity tramples all over that plan. Jesus speaks of sexual immorality here. The Greek word is porneia, from which we get our word like pornography. It's wider than adultery, but the kind of sexual conduct or lifestyle that violates a marriage union in and of itself. Now, of course, then, just as now, you could get a divorce for all kinds of reasons. But if you did, then Jesus is saying remarriage, and in the culture of the day, singleness was a rarity, remarriage and the sexual union that involved would be the indecency that destroyed God's plan for the original marriage. Jesus' understanding of marriage, you see, shapes his understanding of divorce. He hates it. And it doesn't take long for the penny to drop on how radical a rewriting of the divorce debate this is. And now it's not the Pharisees that come back, but his own followers. See, look at verse 10. The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry." The disciples said to him, "The wedding's off then." Now remember, in the culture of the day, there was a sense of duty to marry, but Jesus' teaching on marriage gives it a permanence the culture then sought and now seeks to escape. But Jesus calls us to our Creator, not to the culture, not to ours any more than to theirs. Now, of course, even at its best, divorce is difficult and divorce settlements can be painful. It's one flesh that's being torn. And I understand that prenuptial agreements may save on lawyers' fees, but we do have to expose the sham of marriages that build those into them. You know, the shocking lack of integrity when on the one hand I pledge myself to someone till death us do part, and on the other hand I say to them, but if I decide divorce us do part, here's how we'll split the spoils. Better not to marry? I mean, the shock in the disciples' tone, I think, is the equivalent of, you can't say that, not these days. Better not to marry? And they don't mean, well, we're better off just living together. They know God forbade sex outside of marriage. Now, they are staring celibacy in the face. Well, now he's got their attention. Is Jesus going to back off and water down the teaching? Well, it would be a first, wouldn't it? No, he speaks of the kingdom's call as he fronts up to celibacy. Look at verse 11. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it's been given. Now, there's some dispute about which word is this word. Was it what Jesus said about marriage or the disciples' response? At their best, they both tend to land up in the same place in the end. I favour the latter. Better not to marry, said the disciples. Yes, says Jesus, it is that for some. But not everyone can or is meant to abstain from marriage. For he goes on, there are eunuchs, castrated men, who were born that way. And there are eunuchs who've been made eunuchs by others. Then royal officials who would be castrated because their jobs took them too close to the royal harem. Today, perhaps, some so scarred by abuse it leaves them unwilling and unable. And there are those, he goes on, and I think this is Jesus's main thrust, there are those who choose to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Not that they've no interest in sex or people of the opposite sex, but the freedoms and flexibilities that singleness can afford give them greater opportunities for the gospel, so they stay single and celibate for the kingdom's sake. And since All Souls' recent history focuses on one man, John Stott, for whom that would be true. I worked for another when I was Dick Lucas's curate, and many of Christians here this morning, you'll have your own personal examples of it. But notice, Jesus is careful not to lay this on every disciple. The one who can accept this should accept it. If the Apostle Paul seemed to live like this, the Apostle Peter was married. Marriage is never reduced to the sinful or the second best, and neither is singleness. And Jesus doesn't deny it can be a call for the sake of the kingdom. I think of others who face that call, friends and some church family members with same-sex attraction, who for the kingdom's sake set their face against giving expression to that attraction. They embrace celibacy for godliness's sake. They need all the support and friendship we can give them. And there Jesus leaves it. You know, the kingdom calls marriage or celibacy. Perhaps he's taking the disciples more seriously than they expect. You know, he sets out the uncompromising demands of marriage. They say, better not to marry. And he faces them with the kingdom's other choice, celibacy. So what are the lessons for us? I mean, if we're looking for a fresh start, it's fairly clear to be a follower of Jesus is going to be a radical start, isn't it? But there may be all kinds of personal issues God is putting his finger on for you this morning. But here are four more general takeaways I believe Jesus is saying to us. The first is preparation and marriage. According to the wedding service, and I think it puts it well, marriage must not be undertaken carelessly, lightly, or selfishly, but reverently, responsibly, and after serious thought. Well, it's why many churches put on marriage preparation courses. Dan Wells runs a great one here, and they're part of the package we offer anyone getting married at All Souls. But it doesn't matter where your wedding's actually taking place. If you're getting married, get on the course, and the sooner the better. The quicker we learn to think of marriage the way Jesus does, the quicker we'll think of ours and shape ours as God designed it. Secondly, something about a pastoral culture that we set. We must guard against the church overemphasizing the family, at least in the sense of marriage and the nuclear family, as if the kingdom never calls to celibacy, as if we treat singles as those who don't matter. And it can happen in churches. Marriage or celibacy are both kingdom choices, and we need to support one another, whichever calling we're living for the now. If it's marriage, it's for life. If it's celibacy, it's at least until marriage. And neither marrieds nor singles need either patronizing or leaving to drift, but holding to the kingdom's call. Third area, what I've called the public square, which is a rather grand term, which may not stretch much beyond the family circle for some, but will be far more extensive for others. I'm talking about those opportunities to shape opinions when it comes to thinking about marriage, divorce, and so on. We mustn't be over-influenced by the tide of opinion, the drift of the culture. We don't build our ethic on the foundation of the morality we see around us. Jesus didn't. But he didn't stay silent either. Even though what he said shook even his followers to the core. So pray for his boldness when we speak of marriage and divorce. And when we remind others of how it was in the beginning. We'll need that boldness if we're going to echo the call of the kingdom to marriage or celibacy. And our nation needs us to recover that voice. Finally, there's what I've called the personal. Because in a crowd like this, a subject like divorce, marriage, this morning is bound to have taken the scabs off some old wounds. We'll have rubbed salt into some open ones. Will have spoken into thoughts and feelings in people's hearts they may not even want to acknowledge are there. It's one of the reasons why there is that selection of books and booklets downstairs. It almost certainly would be good to talk with or pray with a wise friend. But sooner or later, I must face God myself. I may need to face my husband and wife, some girlfriend, boyfriend, but I'll need to face God myself. And the God I face is the Jesus whose grace is deeper than my sin, who sets the demands of the kingdom but calls into that kingdom those of us who fall short of it. The God I face is the one whose promise to us is, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just and will forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And all unrighteousness includes everything we've been talking about this morning. Sooner or later, I must face my God myself. So why don't we begin gathering our thoughts, starting our prayers, facing our God ourselves? Let's give ourselves a pause. Let's use it wisely.